is all glory is to the assembled devotees, all glory is to Shri Guru and Gauranga. Okay, so Om Gana Timadanda Sha, Gananjana Shilakya Chakshur, Miditam, Yena Tasmai, Shri Guru Vena Maha. So, do you want to do simultaneous or you can do simultaneous? Okay. So, last class we talked about Buddhism, and there was a lot more about Buddhism to discuss, but we only have three more days left, including today, to talk about the history of Indian philosophy. And so, basically, what I wanted to touch upon during the next 3 days, if we get an opportunity, hopefully to finish, is today the darshans, the four basic darshans, or viewpoints of Indian philosophy. Then, after that, talk about, actually included in that discussion is the Vedanta philosophy, Mimamsa philosophy, atheistic Vedanta philosophy, and theistic Vedanta philosophy. Then after that, something about Tantras, Puranas, you know, what the Puranas are. Of course, we know what the Bhagavatam is. Itihasas, which is the histories. Whew, a lot of stuff to cover. What I'd like to end up the last day or so, talking about the influence of the Muslim invasions of India, and then ultimately the influence of the Western European invasions of India, economic invasions, and fighting within India, and then ultimately India's contact with modernity, that means the modern civilization. Okay. So, we're going to have to go a little fast, if that's all right with all of you. So get your brains fired up. So, in traditional Indian philosophy, there's four darshans. And the word darshan actually means to see or to view. So there are basically six darshans. Okay, and there's three pairs of those six darshans, or viewpoints on philosophy. Now, the three pairs are, there's Nyaya Vaisheshika, the Purva Mimamsa and the Uttara Mimamsa, and then the Sankhya and Yoga. Okay, and I'm going to explain each one of those, so don't worry. You're going to understand basically what they are. Okay. So the first two we'll go through rather quickly. Nyaya basically means logic. And Nyaya, the philosophy of those who just followed Nyaya was that if you were very logical, you'd be liberated. Which doesn't work, actually. So Nyaya goes along with Vaisheshika, which is the tool. Nyaya is the tool used, because Vaisheshika is the second of the philosophies, the tool used to analyze this material world, and ultimately it's an atomic theory understanding of this world. I'm not going to get into the details. But in other words, analyzing this world using logic and reasoning. And this Vaisheshika is not actually followed nowadays because it's been supplanted by modern atomic theory. That is the atomic theory which came up with the atom bomb. So we don't need Vaisheshika anymore. So the first two darshans. The next two are called Mimamsa and Vedanta. We're going to discuss these in depth in a few minutes. So the word Mimamsa which is called sometimes called the Purva Mimamsa, the beginning Mimamsa. Means the word means actually to think about things really hard. And sometimes this Mimamsa is called the it's called Karma Mimamsa, sorry. So the Karma Mimamsa means that it basically, if you act according to your duty, you do a nice thing, the demigods, even if they exist, and God, even if he exists, will give you a good result. And we'll speak more about that in a few minutes. And then the Uttara Mimamsa is the Vedanta, both personal and impersonal. And the last two are Sankhya and Yoga. The word Sankhya means to enumerate or to list, and it's the enumeration of the elements of this world. Not talking about the normal periodic table, the elements you may have studied in the university, like, you know, hydrogen, oxygen, and stuff like that. But the elements, the traditional Vedic elements, like earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, false ego, along with the senses, the perceptive senses and the active senses. Perceptive means, you know, the sense of hearing, the sense of sight, the sense of smell, the sense of touch, the sense of taste, and the active senses, like the voice and the locomotion, etc. So that's Sankhya philosophy. So there's atheistic Sankhya philosophy and theistic Sankhya philosophy. The atheistic Sankhya philosophy was taught by the atheistic Kapiladeva, and the theistic was taught by Lord Kapiladeva. And finally, I know there's a lot of philosophy, it's not interesting stuff like the last few classes, but anyway, finally there's yoga. And most of you have heard about yoga. The word yoga means basically to connect yourself with the Supreme, from the root word yuj, which means connect. Also, in English we have the word religion, which also means to reconnect yourself. So yoga was presented traditionally by a personality named Patanjali, who wrote the Yoga Sutras. And we're going to do a little bit of analysis of it right now. So most of the times in the Western world, you go to these yoga schools, and they will, first of all, they will start teaching asanas and pranayama, which are not the primary stages of yoga, primary steps of yoga, which we're going to talk about. And also they will be teaching an impersonal understanding of yoga. And even they will misquote Patanjali, who is the author of the Yoga Sutras. So we're gonna quote Patanjali right now. So the first Yoga Sutra says, now we're going to present yoga. That's easy. So it's interesting. Anyway, so that's of interest, actually, when he says, now we will present yoga. That's very much similar to the first verse in the Vedanta Sutra, where it's stated, Atato Brahma Jigyasa, now we're going to look for the absolute truth, or now is the time to look for the absolute truth. Because these statements indicate that something else went before it. That is, the understanding that there is a higher reality of this world, or to this world, than just what meets the eye. Anyway. So, the second verse, it says, yoga means to stop the turning of the mind. And most yoga teachers in the Western world will tell you that this second verse means to stop the mind. I don't know if any of you have gone to a Western yoga instructor. They'll say, well, what you have to do is actually stop the mind. But Patanjali says, stop the turning of the mind. And the word he uses in Sanskrit is vritti. So that's a very interesting word. And there's words in English, and I don't know about Croatian, but there's words in English that are very similar to this word, that come from this word. Like the word vert. Like in English we have vert, vritti, which in English we have like invert, subvert. And for all of you who are a little bit unusual, pervert. You've heard that word before? No.
Yeah, also vertical.
Yeah, vertical. Which is really interesting. So this is the same, it comes from the same Sanskrit root, vert. So yoga means basically to control the mind. I mean, if you have to really summarize what he's saying. But he's not saying to stop the mind, as most yoga teachers will tell you. And Patanjali ends the Yoga Sutras by stating, in the fourth chapter, text 34 of the Yoga Sutras, Patanjali Uvacha, that pure perceptual power, which is the purpose of supreme consciousness, is a little difficult, abides in its true nature when the qualities of material phenomena are recognized as intrinsically empty. Sorry about that one. All right, let me put it in a simple way. Then you can actually see that through spiritual vision, premanjana charita bhakti vilochanena, let me put it in terms of what our philosophy is. When your consciousness is absorbed in your true nature, when you realize material phenomena, you know, is ultimately temporary, not real in that sense. And of course, there's many verses that we have that illustrate the same point. What's that? Someone's cell phone? Oh, Jay, I know. Nasato vichite bhavo nabhavo vichite sataha ubayora pitristo antas 20 astad vidarshabi, that those things which are temporary are considered unreal by the sages. Okay. So, that's Patanjali's statement. So, Patanjali is definitely a theist, and we're going to give some more statements by Patanjali. He says about samadhi, perfection of samadhi comes from devotion to the Lord. He says, Ishvara Paridana, which is the Sanskrit, which means giving your heart or being devoted or being absorbed in the Lord, is the perfection or the highest stage of samadhi. And of course, he lists various stages of samadhi, but he says the perfection or the highest stage of samadhi is devotion to the Lord. This is similar to what verse in the Bhagavad Gita? Anyone know? Nobody knows Bhagavad Gita here. That's the book that was spoken by Krishna 5,000 years ago in the battle of Kurukshetra to Arjuna's devotee. That's right. You win the prize. You graduated from the fifth stage of the bhakti, whatever school. So, Yoginam api sarvesham adbhagatein anturatmana shadavan bhajate yomam saame yuktatamo mataha. That of all yogis, he is considered most perfect who is devoted to me. Okay. So, let's go over the yoga processes, or the processes of yoga. There are 8 parts. There's yam, niyam, asana, pranayam, pratyahara, dharana, jhana, and samadhi. And I'm going to describe each one of them. Yam means not something delicious. Like you have that saying in Croatian, yum yum or something? Like that?
No.
Yum yum. So yum means basically restrictions. And that's where the name Yamaraj came from, which means the king of restrictions. Yam and Yamaraj. So the restrictions which Patanjali advocates are as follows. Ahimsa, which means nonviolence. Satya, truth. Astya, no stealing. Brahmachari, that means no illicit sex life. And non-possession of anything. Okay? So those are the yamas. The next one is niyama. And these are positive injunctions. Be clean. Be satisfied, tushti. That means satisfied with whatever Krishna has given you. Study texts that focus on the deity. And devotion to Krishna again. Okay, I have to be very... I should be very clear about this. He doesn't specifically say Krishna, he says Ishvara in his Yoga Sutras. But it is understood that Krishna is Parameshwara. Okay? Okay, so those are the first two. So, in other words, before you get on to the other processes of yoga, you're supposed to master these first two. Then, you get to sit on your asana. Like your Vyasasana. No, not like the Vyasasana. Asana means basically sitting positions. Where is Gokul Chandra? He's not here right now. There he is. You want to show us? Come here. Now you're going to give a demonstration. So we're going to have like a practical demonstration of what some sitting positions are. Okay, do one of the real strange ones where you stand on your head or something. Do another one for us. Yeah, you did so many. You know, 5,000 yoga asanas. He's sitting upside down, see? So, that was practical asana. And then, after that is pranayama, which means breathing. After that is pratyahara, withdrawing the senses from all material external objects. Dharana, which means being steady, nishta. Jhana, which means meditation. And finally, samadhi. And the word samadhi comes from sung, which means complete, and ad, which means intending, and di, which means mind or meditation. Ad means your intention. Sa, mad, e. So, got it? Alright. Sang, thung, mad, di. Okay, got it. Yeah. Oh, the names from 5 to 8? Okay. So, Dasanam Pranaya. 6, 7, 8. Dharana, Dharana, which means to be steady. Dhyana, Dhyana, which means meditation. And samadhi, which means complete focus of the mind. Now that's similar to the word sankirtan. In sankirtan, can actually mean two things. It can mean Sangha Kirtan, which means big Kirtan. It can also mean Sankirtan, which is the complete chanting. I mean, complete absorption in the chanting. Everybody understands that? Two things the word Sankirtan can mean. Okay. That's yoga. Exciting process, right? It's super exciting. I know when just a little funny thing. I stay over Gokul Chandra's house in Finland. And we have our morning program every morning. I'm chanting Hare Krishna, and he's standing on his head chanting Hare Krishna. But I haven't figured out how he can hold his beads being upside down yet, but he's mastered the process. Okay. Next exciting topic. I know these are all exciting. That's why we're going very quickly through them. Because I'm not so excited by them. But it's important to understand them. Is Mimamsa. And first we'll do Purva Mimamsa. As we said before, the word mam means to think. And Mimamsa means to think real hard. So, these were actually the ritualistic people, the super ritualistic people in the Vedic system. They were fighting against. They were fighting against Buddhism. Also, was it one of the groups that actually fought against the Buddhism and Jainism and the and others who rejected the ritualistic Vedic path, the Shramanas. They fought against the Shramanas. They were the super technocrats. In other words, they had ritualism down to a science. You know, how much ghee did you put in the fire when you said this mantra? What type of spoon did you use to put the ghee in the fire? How did you tie your sika? What kind of hat did you have when you were doing the ritual fire sacrifice? What time of day was it? So historians say that in the history, in human history, never was there a time where ritualism was so much defined and so much defended as in the time of the Mimamsas. These were the super ritualists. Okay. And so there were two types of rituals the Mimamsas did. One was state rituals, and we're talking about Ashwamedha, Gomedha sacrifices for the kings and the emperors, and home sacrifices. The Brahmana would always have his little sacrifices that he did every day at home. So the purpose of the sacrifice always involved fire. And the purpose of that was that the fire would transmit the offerings from the earth planet to the heavenly planets. And in this way, the demigods would depend on these offerings in order to exist. And so, what's that? It's hot. It definitely is, yeah. So, the demigods, though, were not considered to be independent entities in the sense that they could not act independently. The demigods were more or less like government functionaries. For example, let's say the place where you go to pay your taxes here. there's a tax collector, you know, someone who sits at the desk, takes your money. Now, he's not independent of the government. He doesn't have independent discrimination above and beyond the law, right? Maybe he does. That's called bribery, but that's a different subject matter. Anyway, so let's say in a government where everything was strict, the government agent is just that. So in other words, if you did your dharma properly, if you did your sacrifice properly, the demigods had to give you the good result. And that's actually what Krishna taught to Nanda Maharaj in the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. When Krishna was attempting to dissuade Nanda Maharaj from performing the Indra Yajna. You all know that story? Krishna said, even if Indra exists, if we do our duty, Indra will have to give us rain or the results from our duties. So in this way, he insulted Indra, which was part of his plan to get Indra angry so that Indra would try to kill all the residents of Vrindavan, and then Krishna could save all the residents of Vrindavan by lifting the Govardhan Hill. So dharma for these people was the laws that govern the universe. In the Greek system, that's called logos. So you find a similar conception there. Like in the Bible we mentioned before, usually you find the translation, in the beginning was the word, but the actual literal meaning or the literal words are, in the beginning was the logos. Logos means the world order or the universal order. And this logos exists independently of any person. It's just there. Of course, as Vaishnavas, we understand that if you're going to have laws like logos, world order, there has to be someone who is the law giver. I mean, you don't find laws without any person who's written the laws. And this is basically atheistic philosophy. They said the Vedas eternally exist. They use the word aparashaya, which means they're not written down or given by any person. They're always there. Somehow or other, they're always there. Even though no one wrote them, no one's given them, there's no God. Demigods are just like instruments of the sacrifice, like the spoon you use. So I have a spoon, and there's Indra on the other hand, or Agni on the other hand. And somehow the Vedas are there. I mean, this is very similar to modern scientists understanding things. You got, you know, laws of nature. And you ask them, you know, about the laws, and they say, well, they just are. And generally, we find that people, or scientists, or people in general, misunderstand or don't understand the difference between how and why questions. I'll give you an idea what I mean. When we were young, most children, when they're young, ask the question, you know, Mommy, why is the sky blue? You heard that question before, right? Why is the sky blue? So our mother will answer, it's blue because of the refraction of the light that passes through the atmosphere at a particular angle. Everyone's heard of this explanation? And the light beam is actually bent, just like you have a prism. You know what a prism is? Prism. Like when I was young, I would take apart my mother's chandeliers. You know what chandelier is? And they would have Austrian crystals in them. She didn't like that when I took it apart. But I would look through the world and see different colors. It was really nice. You know, the world was much more beautiful than it is today. So generally our mothers explain something scientific, or at the schools they explain something scientific. But that's not a why answer. That's a how answer. You know, if you want to ask a why answer, why is the sky blue? A why question. Then the answer would not be the mechanism by which the sky becomes blue. It would be, you know, Krishna wants it that way. Which, Prabhupada actually gave an answer like that. He said, you know, the sky is blue because it's a reflection of Krishna's color in the spiritual world. So Prabhupada gave a why answer to that question. Whereas most scientists, they will give a how answer. Like it's saying, for example, let's say you came here to the summer camp, and I ask you, why did you come here to the summer camp? And you answer, I came here in a car. So you're answering the how question, not the why question. You understand the difference? So generally, when people are talking about the material world, they're always asking the how question, but they're using the why word. So anyway, so in any case, these mimamsas, the Purva mimamsas, were atheistic, and they said the purpose of all the sacrifice is to go to heaven. And the main person who wrote about mimamsas is called Jaimini. And so, let's see. Okay, this is interesting. The mimamsas said that gods have no discretionary power. All is within our power. And there's another extreme to that, which is called predestination, which is nothing is within our power. I'm just contrasting these two different aspects of philosophy. You know, some people say, I mean, I'll give you an example. Let's say that modern movie, The Secret. Anyone's heard of that movie? No. No one's heard of the movie. That's like a mimamsa philosophy. That's modern mimamsa philosophy. If you want something enough, you know, of course, they didn't talk about sacrifices there in that movie. Not that I remember. But anyway, if you want something enough, you concentrate on it enough, you're positive about it enough, it'll come. In that movie, it showed a man who wanted a sports car. Does anyone remember the movie? Yeah. A man wanted a sports car. So he would sit in his chair in his living room. And he would shift the car in his chair. You know, he wanted it so much, concentrate on it, did a sacrifice for the car, you know, whatever. And he sat on his chair, like that, driving his chair in his imagination. Then he looked outside his door, and there was that sports car. What type of sports car was it? Do you remember? Anyone remember the movie? Ferrari or something? Anyway, so, and there was a boy who wanted a bicycle. Similar thing happened. So, that's almost like mimamsa. That if we really do the right thing, we'll get our result. So the opposite extreme to that is predestination. That means whatever we do, it doesn't matter. And we find a lot of devotees get into that also. Because they said, it's my horoscope, Prabhu. I'm supposed to have spiritual trouble now. You know, and you know, one devotee even said to me, well, it's, the stock market is supposed to go down, supposed to go up. I'm going to invest this way or that way. I said, uh-oh. Leave me out of this. Anyway, so they get so much into the stars. Actually, that's another point about astrology. Astrology, even if you have an expert astrologer, he can predict more or less what the general atmosphere is going to be. For example, we can go and look at the weather report for today. And we can see it's going to be hot, right? It's hot? It's going to be, what, 30, 35 degrees today? Okay. So I can look at that weather report and say it's going to be hot. I'm going to sit outside in the sun and be hot all day long. Because the weather report says that. Or I can get a fan, or I can get an air conditioner. I don't have to be subjected to that weather report, except when I'm giving the seminar. or I can go swimming. You know, there's all sorts of things I can do. Yes, the weather's going to be such and such and such. But you can do all sorts of things within the purview of the weather. Do you understand the difference? All right, so there's these two extremes. In Christian, let's go into Christian history. That before St. Augustine, some of you might have remembered him, people pretty much believed in free will. In other words, it's not your acts are not predetermined. You have the ability to do sinful things or pious things or godly things according to your will. This is very interesting in Christian history. Then after St. Augustine, there was the doctrine of determinism. That is, you know, the devil made me do it. Just put it in. You've heard about that before? You know, I'll speak it more simply because I think some of you heard this before. Everyone is sinful. You know, that's it. You know, the only thing you can do is believe in Jesus, but you can't really change your sinfulness. Don't get on my case, Prabhu. You know, everyone's sinful. And of course, you hear that in the movement. Nobody's perfect. Don't go around acting like a pure devotee. We're all conditioned souls. You know, of course, one should be humble and think he's a conditioned soul. But at the same time, we can become perfect by serving Srila Prabhupada and following the Krishna conscious process. So, later on, after St. Augustine, you know, started to develop this philosophy actually was based upon the writings of Paul. And Paul came later after the apostles, of course. And he has the famous statements, it's not by works alone, etc., 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 that you can... So, anyway, so what happened is that later on, other theologians, such as Martin Luther, accepted this doctrine of determinism, and Augustine's philosophy won out in the church. And so technically, in Christian history, this is called Manichaean philosophy. Anyone's ever heard that word before? Manichaean. And it's not, that means this, this man, marionette or someone who's crazy. It's Manichaean philosophy, which is the philosophy of determination. Determinism. We are flawed. We are not responsible for our actions. And that's, under that philosophy, the church is functioning today. And it's interesting, also, amongst Ramanujacharya's followers, they split in those two directions, too. Determinism and free will. Does everyone follow this? This is actually quite interesting. Because we're contrasting something that happened in Christianity with something that happened within the Vedic purview. Okay, and just one final thing about the Mimamsa people. They said mobile phones are real. Oh, sorry. they said language is real and eternal. This world is real. The varieties in this world are real. And the Buddha said exactly the opposite. Said language is not real. Varieties is not real. This world is not real. And they wrote many books about how things are not real. Which is really interesting. Like if they say, language is not real, then why are you going to write books? Then why write so many books, isn't it? Then what you're writing about language not being real, you're writing in language about language not being real, and that's unreal. Think about the contradiction. Make sense? Okay. Okay, enough for our Mimamsa people. Then we go into the okay. This is okay. Then we go into the Uttara Mimamsa, which is the Vedanta philosophy. And just to review a little bit, there's the four original Vedas, the Rig, Sama, Atharva, and Yajurveda. After that came the Brahmana literature, the Aranyakas, that means the literature of the forest dwellers who left society, and the Upanishads. The word Upanishad is composed of three words. Up, Ni, and Sad. Which basically means, come near, sit down. That's what it means. Come near and sit down. Because in order to understand the Upanishads, you have to come near to the spiritual master and sit down and hear, inquire submissively, as Krishna says in the Gita, Tadvidi pranipatena paripashnena sevaya. And the Upanishads were dealing with esoteric subject matters and a secret things that had to be revealed by the spiritual master. Okay. Now the Upanishads were commented on by the Brahma Sutra, which is sometimes called the Vedanta Sutra. You've heard of the Vedanta Sutra before? So this Vedanta Sutra is interesting because it's a commentary. If you take each verse of the Vedanta Sutra, each verse is a commentary on specific Upanishads. And so the commentaries on the Vedanta Sutra or the Brahma Sutra were written by Ramanujacharya, Shankaracharya, and others. So also in the Upanishad, another point about the Upanishads, sometimes the Upanishads criticize the ritualistic Vedas. And for the few ladies, some of the Upanishad speakers were ladies, like Gargi and Maitreyi. So that's nice, isn't it? So there was equality even in the Upanishads for the ladies. Good. And Buddha also took some of the information from the Upanishads to present his skandhas. Remember we talked about the five skandhas that Buddha presented? Those things which we are not, like the body, the perceptions, and everything like that. So, in the sermon at Deer Park, Buddha utilized a lot of Upanishadic knowledge in his philosophical presentation. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the Vedanta Sutra. The first sutra in the Vedanta Sutra is Atato Brahma Jigyasa. Now, in other words, now, the implicit meaning is now that you've understood there's more to life than, you know, just ordinary life, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. Now is the time to inquire about Brahman. Because usually you don't start a text or a book by saying, now that you've done this, but the Vedanta Sutra actually starts like that. In the same way the Yoga Sutra starts. And the second sutra is Janma Jasya Yataha. I think some of you are familiar with that verse. The absolute truth is that which from everything comes. The third sutra is Shastra Yunitvat. Knowledge comes from Shastra. So in this way, the Vedanta Sutra commented on the Upanishads. So every authorized sampradaya had to have a commentary to be considered authorized on the Vedanta Sutra. So the first commentary, one of the first commentaries, sorry, that was written in the 8th to the 9th century AD in Kerala. And if anyone has any questions while we're going through all this philosophical detailed stuff, please raise your hand, because I want to make it a little more interesting. And so that commentary was written by Shankaracharya. And this commentary dealt with the unity of Atman and Brahman. In other words, the self with Brahman. It's called non-dualism. Or, to put it in Sanskrit, Advaita philosophy. Advaita means two. Advaita means without two. That means non-dual. So what Shankaracharya did is that he took the Vedic literatures and he blended aspects of Buddhism with the Vedic literatures. And we do understand, according to Srila Prabhupada's teachings, that Shankaracharya is considered to be an incarnation of Lord Shiva. And there's verses that where Lord Shiva says, such as in the Shiva Purana, that in the Kali Yuga I will come down in the guise of a Brahmana and to bewilder the atheists. And that's Shankaracharya. He stated that ultimately Brahman is nirguna, has no qualities. And here's another contradiction. He described that Brahman cannot be described in words. That's a contradiction, isn't it? So if someone comes up to you and says, the absolute truth cannot be described in words, so why you Hare Krishna is describing in words, what will you say to him? What?
That words originally comes from God.
Yeah.
And then words which are not tainted by material energy. Shastric words, Shastra Malaka, they're rooted in the spiritual world, coming down to the chain of spiritual masses are completely pure, and then words can describe God.
Yes, but what would you say originally before you say all that stuff? You just use words. Point out his contradiction. First of all, Prabhupada said when we're talking to someone, at least on the philosophical basis, we should convince someone that they don't know anything. In other words, if someone says, you know, that philosophy or the absolute truth can't be described in words, then why are you using so many words to describe it? That's also words. These are also words, right? The statement. When they're saying cannot be described in words, you're using words to say it cannot be described in words, but you're using words to say it cannot be described. It's a contradiction. And then we can also say, if you actually believe that, then just shut up and listen to what I have to say. You know, don't be a hypocrite. The absolute truth can't be described in words, then shut your mouth. Okay. Okay, so Shankaracharya said that when Maya hits consciousness or hits Brahman, that's why we see variety. But then he doesn't describe what this Maya is. He says everything is Brahman, but he doesn't actually explain what Maya is. Let's see, what other example? He gives so many interesting examples. He gives the rope and snake example, which Srila Prabhupada comments on. He says, sometimes you'll see a rope and you'll think it's a snake. And he said, that's what illusion is. But Prabhupada says, the rope actually exists. Whereas Shankaracharya would say, it's just illusion, everything. He also said that there's two levels of truth, the ordinary truth. In other words, when you're dealing with the normal material world, like this is a seat, this is a microphone, and then there's the ultimate, like everything is one. This is neither a seat, this is not a microphone. I am not me, you are not you. We're all one. And as I said before, he doesn't explain where illusion came from, doesn't explain how you got into illusion. But ultimately, he was a Vaishnava. And he had his mission to bring people back to the Vedic literatures utilizing covered Buddhism. Okay? And then next, we'll talk about Ramanujacharya. I'm going to go quickly through this. Let's see. Ramanujacharya appeared near Chennai, which is Kanchi. And there's stories about his life, how he rejected the ritualistic caste system. In fact, some of his Siksha gurus that he had in his early life were from a lower caste. And because of that, ultimately, his wife committed offenses against his Siksha gurus, and I think some of you know these stories, and gave Ramanujacharya the excuse that he could leave home and take sannyas. Ramanujacharya's philosophy that he presented was different than Shankaracharya's philosophy. It was of a Shishta Dvaita, which basically means, I know sometimes it's translated a little bit differently, but the word Vashishta means basically difference. And Advaita means non-different. So it's very, very similar to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy, which is the Chincha Beda Abeda Tattva, which means inconceivable difference and non-difference simultaneously. So, Ramanujacharya's philosophy was difference and non-difference. Difference and non-difference, same thing. And also he pointed out the fault in Shankaracharya's philosophy, which is where does ignorance come from? He wrote a commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. And of course he was a member of the Sri Sampradaya, Lakshmi Sampradaya. Ramanujacharya taught a philosophy called also Sakaryavad. Sakaryavad means the cause of something is present in the effect. And this is actually very important. This, in the West, this is called natural philosophy. In other words, by examining the universe, you can intuit that God exists. Because you can see the order in the universe. I mean, there's that famous example which Srila Prabhupada gave of Sir Isaac Newton. Sir Isaac Newton constructed a model of the solar system in which the planets were moving around very, very nicely and not colliding with each other. So his friend came and said, Sir Isaac, who has made this nice model? And he answered, no one. It came about by chance. And his friend got angry, and how is this possible? It came about by chance. And then eventually he said, how can you think, can you be sure that this model was constructed by someone and not be sure that the universe was also constructed by someone? So this is called natural theology or natural philosophy. So the cause is present in the effect. It's very important for us to understand this. We also have the philosophy in the Bhagavad Gita in the 15th chapter that this material world is a reflection of the spiritual world. So we can understand something of the spiritual world by seeing this material world. For example, and I've given this example before, that if you watch a Bollywood film, you can understand about Krishna's Rasa Leela. Anyone here ever seen a Bollywood film? All right, so, okay, man meets girl or boy meets girl. What happens? What? There's a dance. And what happens? Not just the dance, not just like the dances that they're practicing over there, you know, some traditional dances. But what type of dance? It's like a circle dance, right? And they all get in a circle around them while the couple is in the middle. I'm not playing a flute all the time, but anyway. Well, the couple's in the middle, enjoying life in the middle of the street in Bombay. And, you know, it's just like Krishna's Rasa dance. So, you see things in this world. I can learn a lot about the spiritual world. I mean, just like, you know, just by seeing young men and young women falling in love, you know, they become bewildered. It's like, according to the brain scan, it's like snorting cocaine. Did you know that? That's a scientific fact. Of course, it wears out after, hate to tell you, after 3 or 4 months. Anyway, so, then you what, cold turkey or something? Is that what you call it? Anyway, so, then you can see how intense the love is for Radha and Krishna, because they never come down from that high, that intensity of love. I was just reading one book. Obviously, I was reading the Lalita Madhava, which is a play written by Srila Rupa Goswami, detailing the intensity of separation that the gopis and the other residents of Vrindavan experience when Krishna leaves Vrindavan, and also how these residents of Vrindavan expand and continue to follow Krishna's pastimes by their expansion, such as like Radharani becomes Satyabhama and Chandravali becomes Rukmini. Anyway, some stories like this. So I'm seeing the intensity of that love. When the gopis, let me give you an example. I mean, it's just so intense. So when Krishna left Vrindavan, the other gopis didn't want to tell Radharani, because she wouldn't be able to bear it. But Radharani sort of intuited, figured out that Krishna had left. Why did she figure it out? How did she figure out? Like all the trees were no longer blossoming anymore in Vrindavan. You know, it became like a desert like you see today. You go to Vrindavan. So she figured out, you know, why is this happening in Vrindavan? Where is Krishna? And everyone kept assuring her, you know, Krishna is just behind that tree. And she couldn't bear the separation so much so that in the Lalita Madhava, it's a play, that she enters into the Jamuna River and leaves this world, actually go to the sun planet, but there's a whole other part of the story. So that, you know, such intense devotion and love. So we see the reflection of that in this world, isn't it? Friendship, whether it's friendship, or conjugal love, or servitorship, or any of these different rasas. Or even like ghastliness. For example, when I was young, we would go every Saturday to see a horror movie. You know what a horror movie is? Like King Kong, Godzilla, Frankenstein, Frankenstein's girlfriend. Really, there's a movie like that. The Wife of Frankenstein. And so, you know, we'd be shaking, like at night, and our mother would have to come into the room and say, "Everything's all right. Frankenstein's not coming to get you." So those same basic, let's say, moods, emotions, and feelings are there in the spiritual realm. There's fear sometimes. I mean, for example, You would sometimes would wonder, how can a snake serve Radha and Krishna? You know, what's the service? Can a snake cook prasadam? Can it stir the sweet rice? I mean, what can a snake do for Radha and Krishna? So why should snakes be there in the spiritual world? So what happened, one pastime is this, you know, this big snake went by Radharani, She got scared, and when she gets scared, what does she do? She grabs Krishna. So there's fear. Maya. Not Maya, Baya. Not Maya. So there's fear there. So everything you see here, in other words, everything you see here in this particular realm is present there in the spiritual world. Even snakes, tigers, everything. Anyway, so, or to give an ordinary example of how the cause is present in the effect, let's say there's a car accident. Anyone's ever seen a car accident? What happens when there's a car accident? I know people get hurt. But no, besides that, when the police come, they investigate, and they look at the effects of the accident, right? They look at the skid marks. You know what skid marks are? Skid marks are where the rubber tires went on the road and the person put his brakes on and you could see the mark on the road. So they look at the effects. They look at the airbag, they look at where the car was hit, and they determine who is guilty, right? Right? Isn't that what they do here? I'm sure they do things like that. So that's what it means to see that the cause is present in the effects. It's a very important. This is a very important point. That's Sakarya Vad. Okay. Another point about. So this is one important aspect of Ramanujacharya's philosophy. Another aspect of Ramanujacharya's philosophy is called the three things which you consider to be real. Jiva, Prakriti, and Ishvara. And of course, this is very much related to the five topics of the Bhagavad Gita which we study. What are the five topics of the Bhagavad Gita? Yeah, Kala, Karma, and then the other three. Jiva, Prakriti, and Ishvara. So a lot of our philosophy comes from Ramanujacharya. So, let's give another example. Nagarjuna. Remember Nagarjuna, our friend from Buddhism? No one remembers. Nagarjuna was the one who said that anything that's dependent on anything else is not real. So, let's give a sports analogy to Nagarjuna's philosophy, Shankaracharya's philosophy, and Ramanujacharya's philosophy. You know, sports, football, soccer. You heard about that before? Okay. So Nagarjuna said, there are no sports teams, only the players. In other words, nothing's real. And Shankaracharya said, there's no players in the sports teams, there's only the teams. In other words, everything's one. And Ramanujacharya said, the teams are real and the players are real. Or the parts are real and the whole is real. Okay. We're not going to tell the story about Ramanujacharya's life. Other than the fact that he had a Mayavadi guru who later on became his disciple, Yadava Prakash, and he became the descendant of Yamunacharya, and he traveled for thousands of miles teaching about Krishna consciousness all over India. Unfortunately, later on, his followers also broke up into two groups. Which is called the Bhadakalai and Tainakalai. Anyway, you don't have to remember these things. Except for one group said human effort is nothing. And another group from South India said let's see, get this right. The Bhadakalai, the South Indian group said, human effort is nothing, it's all God's effort, everything is predestined. And the North Indian group said, Human effort is everything. So this whole dichotomy which we described before between predestination, remember that? And works is also making its way into Ramanujacharya's followers. And the example they gave, the North Indian group gave, when they said human effort is everything, they gave an example of a baby monkey with a mother monkey. When you have a baby monkey with a mother monkey, the baby monkey has to hold on to the mother monkey, right? But the South Indians, the Tenakalais, said that it's like a cat with a kitten. Because when you have a cat with a kitten, the cat holds on to the kitten doesn't hold on to the cat, you know, no effort. So use that example. You can use that example to illustrate predestination versus free will. Next time you're talking to someone about free will versus predestination, say, well, free will means you're like a monkey holding on to your mother monkey, and predestination means you're like a cat being held by your mother cat. Okay. So any questions about that? I wanted to go real quickly because this is just basic philosophical stuff. It's important to understand in the history of India. Either tomorrow or in the next 5 minutes, we could start to get into the next topics. Any questions or comments about anything we said? Yeah.
Now, a logical question is, where is our position between predetermination and free will?
That's interesting. Our position is not to either extremes. Our position is one that we make an effort. Krishna provides the, as it stated, Krishna says, I am the ability of man, I'm the strength of the strong, and the intelligence of the intelligent. So we have to make some effort. But Krishna provides us with the ability to make that effort, the intelligence to make that effort, the strength to make that effort, and the success or failure is up to Krishna in one sense, but in another sense, Krishna describes in the Gita that there's five factors of action. He says that there's, you know, the place, the doer, the endeavor, the person, and ultimately the super soul. So all these work together. So in other words, Krishna has given us free will, but it's not unlimited free will. It's not like you would say that the movie The Secret presents. The Secret presents the free will in such a way that if you really want something enough, you meditate on it, think positively about it, you'll get it. In our philosophy, you really want something enough, think about it, meditate on it enough. If you have good karma, if you're not a devotee, you'll get it in accordance with how much good karma you want. I'll give you an example. Let's say I really want a Ferrari. You know Ferrari? Everyone knows what a Ferrari is? No. No. Okay. A Yugo. Alright, anyway, Ferrari. Everyone knows. Ferrari is like a 300,000 euro car, right? Some of them. I really want a Ferrari. I'm meditating on a Ferrari. Meditating. And I have a lot of good karma. I get my Ferrari, but then I use up all that good karma. And then I have to build it up again. Or if I don't have so much good karma, let's say I have a little good karma, then I open my door the next day and there's a Yugo there. So it depends not just on free will. For someone who's not Krishna conscious, all right, so there's two types of people. For someone who's not Krishna conscious, it depends on your karma and your free will. It's like when you go to buy a car, what determines what type of car you're going to get, your desire, and your money. So karma, desire. So they both work together for someone who's not Krishna conscious. For someone who is Krishna conscious, or at least chanting, following the rules and regulations, then Krishna will give you something if it won't impede your spiritual progress. So Krishna always has that consideration. So there's that consideration too. And also Krishna gives you things that test you in spiritual life. Also Krishna takes away things that are not so good. Yashaha madhu grihami. So there's the Krishna hand, and you're also, so they're working together.
Spiritual desires
too, yeah. Spiritual desires are the same way. So it's basically, Krishna says in the Gita, I mean, you can matak smritir jnanam aponam cha, the famous verse 15:15 of the Gita. Sarvasya chaham vidhi sanavishto matak smritir jnanam aponam cha. Depending upon your desire, you get specific intelligence. Intelligence, remembrance, and forgetfulness. So it's your desire and your actions in accordance with that desire, along with Krishna's will. So it's working together. It's somewhere in between free will and predestination. It's a good question. It's not just predestination. It's not just free will. Free will would mean we could get whatever we wanted. Like that secret movie. Where in the secret movie, I mean, I hate to talk about that stupid movie. But anyway, in the secret movie, the universe was like Aladdin's genie, right? Right? And the genie said, whatever you want, master, I will get for you. Now, I wish the universe was like that, or maybe I don't. But anyway, I wouldn't be sitting here today. Maybe it would be. But anyway, I wouldn't be sitting here today if the universe was like that. I'd be arriving in my helicopter. We'd have an air-conditioned tent. And each person would have like headphones with simultaneous translation, wireless, and I'd have like a super iPhone I could look at, you know, this and the whole thing would be broadcast internationally, you know. And after the class, everybody would be offering me €1,000 donation. So anyways. Yeah, deep pockets, you know, big cape and everything like that. So in other words, we don't get always what we want. Because it wouldn't be good for me either. Is there any other quick questions? I know it's real philosophical today. Tomorrow we're going to get onto more interesting stuff like Tantra. We'll have a demonstration of Tantra. No, we won't. Tomorrow. Tantra, Puranas, and then we get into the invasion of India, the various invasions of India, beginning with the Muslim invasions, and then culminating with the Western European invasions. Yeah.
There's a new modern philosophy, sort of cause and effect philosophy. It's called intelligent design.
Yeah.
And it directly opposes today's Darwinism and
Yeah, intelligent design is actually quite an interesting philosophy. That they say that, you know, evolution could have occurred. I'm just going to summarize it, but it was designed intelligently by someone. Now that intelligent design philosophy is rejected by evolutionary people, obviously, because their whole philosophy is everything has come about by chance. You know, chance mutations in the genetic and the genes. And there's one interesting film that I highly recommend to everyone. Yeah, the name of the film is Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed. Has anyone seen that film? No one's seen the film. Expelled, the name is Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed. And it's a film based on a series of interviews with people who try to present intelligent design as a practical alternative, how they lost their academic positions when they actually presented it as an alternative. Not saying that they were advocates of it, but they said that this is a possibility or one of the other philosophies that's going around. So, anyway, so science is so much slanted. The presentation of science, interpretation of science, the academic understanding of science is so much slanted towards atheism they won't even allow the discussions of a positive or possible alternative to that. And the people who do present an alternative are expelled from their positions at the university. That's why that film was called Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed. And I highly recommend that film for devotees because it can actually help you when you're preaching to intelligent people at the university level when you're talking about evolution. Now, on the other hand, if you're going to be talking to people about evolution, you better know what you're talking about. Don't come out with a bunch of quotes saying, this is evolution is bad, it's all atheism, etc., etc. You better be able to scientifically explain it using information theory, which is scientific, you know, mathematical theories and other theories to be able to deal with people. If you can't use scientific language, then better not to be talking about this with university people. But this film can give you a lot of background information about the subject matter. I don't usually recommend films.
I saw this. I thought it was pretty good. It was an evangelist preacher. And
yeah.
He says the title was 100 Reasons Why Evolution is Stupid. And I thought that was a rather good lecture. It was about an hour and a half. And really, really good reasons why evolution is stupid. And he also gave these reasons. Genetic and everything.
Yeah, there's mathematical reasons, genetic reasons. I mean, dealing with the theory of probability. But you better know about these things before you start talking about these things. Otherwise, you'll appear... Like when I was a new devotee, I'll give you an example. I wrote to Prabhupada. I was a new devotee about 1 week in the movement. And I thought I was a pure devotee. So anyway, so I wrote to Prabhupada. I didn't say, Prabhupada, I'm a pure devotee. I mean, obviously. I said, Prabhupada, I want to start a college preaching program. You know, 1 week in the movement, you know, what am I going to talk about at the universities, you know? Basically just stay high forever or something like that. But so Prabhupada said, you know, better get educated first before you could do this, because if you're not educated when approaching intelligent people, it will have the opposite effect. So if we're going to approach a certain type of person to present Krishna consciousness, we better be able to speak their language. If anyone needs any references or help in that regard, I can give it to them, because basically my background is science. You know, science, engineering, mathematics in the university level. And so I'm able to understand these things and give a little guidance to the devotees how to preach on that basis. But I'm not going to give a class about that because it's pretty boring. Okay? Any other questions or comments? Yes?
You probably heard about Richard Dawkins and his book, Illusion of God.
Yeah. See,
somebody from the woods tried to oppose him and try to make some competent arguments.
The thing about Richard Dawkins, he's a physicist. And he's a very intelligent physicist. But he doesn't know beans about epistemology. And so epistemology basically means the science of knowledge. You know, how do you know what you know? So that's the problem with his presentation and the presentation of most of, you know, evolutionary theorists, is they've never studied philosophy. So it is very easy. I mean, we could take Richard Dawkins' book and basically tear it apart on the epistemological basis. I mean, in other words, you know, how to get your knowledge. Like Prabhupada, that's the first thing Prabhupada talks about is epistemology in the Nectar of the Isopanishad. First thing Prabhupada mentions is epistemology. Did you know that? He doesn't use that word. But what does he talk about in the Isopanishad? Does anyone know? Anyone here ever read Isopanishad?
Yeah.
What is the first thing Prabhupada talks about? I'll give you a hint. Four.
Four defects
in our process of acquiring knowledge. What are the four defects?
We make mistakes.
We cheat.
And
our senses are imperfect. So that's an epistemological understanding. And then Prabhupada talks also about the descending process, which is the process of induction. What is the process of induction? That you take certain things that happen in this world and you draw a general conclusion. Like, for example, every time I have come here to the summer camp, it has been hot. Alright? So that's my experience. Therefore, I can conclude that every summer is as hot as hell here. But what's wrong about that conclusion? Nothing wrong. No, there is right. There is something wrong because I have not experienced every summer. And I'm sure that there has been a summer where it's been cold. I mean, just like looking at it elsewhere. So the inductive process means to take certain limited experiences, examples, and draw a general conclusion. That's the ascending process. And the descending process is, you know, to accept authority from higher, from above. And that's our process of Krishna consciousness. Do you understand that? You know, or the example Prabhupada gives is that of induction is that we see my father died, his father died, his father's father died. Therefore we conclude everyone dies. But that's not necessarily true because there may be someone who hasn't died. I mean, maybe like God. You know, so I'm imperfect, you're imperfect, therefore God's imperfect. That's another inductive conclusion. So when one, in other words, it's important when talking to people who are educated, whether it's Richard Hawkins or this person or that person, to understand something about epistemology. And in philosophy, there's different branches, of course. There's epistemology, ontology, teleology, metaphysics, logic. You understand? These are the main branches of philosophy. Epistemology means the science of knowledge. How do you know what you know? Like someone can try to defeat you on that basis. Like you say, Krishna is God. How do you know? How do you know Krishna is God? What's your... You know, I don't think Krishna is God. How do you know Krishna is God? Right? That's the epistemological argument. And of course, we have an answer. We have many answers. Param Dharma, Param Brahma, Pavitram, Paraman Bhavatam. You know, there's an answer from the Gita. There's an answer from the Disciplic Succession. Answer from our own experience. There's an answer. Anyway, we have so many different answers to that. How we know Krishna is God. So epistemology is extremely important. Okay? Yeah.
There was a great debate between Sri Aurobindo and some philosopher from Oxford.
Yeah.
And epistemology is also the main thing that Sri Aurobindo said in that debate. And from that point on, the debate was...
The guy lost the debate.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's easy to defeat someone on the epistemological basis. Like if someone says there's no God, all you got to do is ask him, how do you know? And then he'll say, well, I don't know. It just makes sense. Yeah.
Shivaram Swami answered in this scientific way. He says, well, everything we find out in this world, we experiment.
Yeah.
So also the presence of God can be also
experienced.
Experience, but it's not a material experiment, it's a
spiritual experience. Yeah.
And we all have the freedom to try to experiment, and then we can judge whether God exists.
Yeah. That's good. Like Prabhupada would say, in simple words, Prabhupada would say the proof of the pudding is in the tasting.
He didn't contradict experimenting.
Yeah.
So it is.
Yeah, we can. If we experience, we can't prove a negative. It's impossible to prove a negative, but you can prove a positive. Do you understand? You can prove that God exists because all you have to do is see him once. But you can't prove that God doesn't exist. It's an impossible proof. So we've won already. Just on the basis of logic, we've won because you can't prove a negative. Right?
And there was also this point, this philosopher said you have to prove that God exists. And we don't have to prove that God doesn't exist. And of course, Sharam Swami said it. In the same way you have to prove that God doesn't exist, the same as we have.
We can prove God does exist, and we have a method of proof.
Yeah. We both have to prove.
Yeah, we both, everyone has to prove, but you can't prove a negative.
Yeah. But they feel, they just feel that they
like, I can't prove that you don't exist. I mean, I cannot prove that a 200-legged lion doesn't exist. It's impossible for me to prove it. How can I prove it? Unless I was God. See, that's an impossible proof. But if it did exist, and I'm not saying it did, I could prove it does. I mean, just like this whole thing with the abominable snowman? You ever heard of him before? No. Yeti? You can't prove he doesn't exist. Sasquatch. Yeah, Sasquatch. Or the Loch Ness Monster, anyone's heard of him? He's one of your European monsters. Anyway, so, you can't prove he doesn't exist. It's quite funny, you know. You can't prove a negative. Okay. I think that's it, because we're holding up the next class, the next session. All right, tomorrow we will introduce more details like this. Okay. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.